you. For those of you that don't know me, I'm a professor of sorghum breeding and genetics at Texas A&M University. I've been there for 20 years and was asked to talk today. We have had in the past significant work in the Central America region as part of the USAID Instramil program from 1996 until 2012 when it was closed out in working with sorghum in the Central America region. And one of the projects that we finished the program with involved a specific type of brown midrib forage quality sorghum and its development, then adoption in the past 3 to 5 years since it's been released. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about the development of that project, how it evolved, and then what we did and where we think it's at today, because like I say, the end of the story is that the project is finished and these guys are on their own to continue it internally in the region. So if you look at sorghum in Central America, obviously corn is the primary cereal grain crop, summer grain crop, and it takes most of the land area in terms of production. Corn is also very, very much a food grade crop in that area of the world. It's not considered a feed crop. Sorghum occupies land primarily as a feed grain and a forage, and also for a fair sizable amount of the population as a fail-safe food security crop in case the corn crop fails. And in that sense, when we talk about Central America, there's really three types of sorghums that they grow. The first one are the criollos, which are a photoperiod sensitive grain sorghum crop and forage crop as well, that are grown by the very poor sector of producers in that region. They often intercrop it with corn, planting the corn first, then plant the sorghum or the criollos. The criollos are very photoperiod sensitive and they grow vegetatively as the corn matures, and then in September and October, after the corn has been harvested and broken down, as you can see in the upper picture, sort of, the sorghum grows up and matures a crop in November, December, and January, and they use it. If their corn crop is good, they use the sorghum as a feed grain. If the corn crop is bad, they use it as a food grain, and the forage is left for the animals to consume. The second type of sorghum that's grown in the region is what I would call a dual-purpose forage sorghum. It has good grain quality, and they can use it as a grain crop. It's an insensitive type that grows within a normal growing season in that region. But the primary focus of this has been in the dairies. The dairies in the region utilize these varieties. These are varieties as well. Small dairies, small farms, because most of those dairies are very small, but they use it as either a silage, a forage, or a green chop, or a grain, depending on the season and depending on the year. They often prefer it because they can plant it in June and then cut it in August, allow it to regrow and get a second crop, and in some cases even a third crop, depending on the year. And that's been an important part of the industry. And then the last group is actually hybrid grain sorghum production, strictly for feed. In some parts of Nicaragua, where they do employ larger scale farming, these folks will plant hybrid grain sorghum in the second phase of the second season, in the dry season, as a crop, as you see in the bottom picture. The purpose and what we're going to talk about, I just want to give you that background. Where we're going to focus in this effort is in that second group of dual-purpose forage sorghums. And if we talk about dairy production in this region, most of the livestock producers, whether they be beef or dairy, are very small landholders. They don't have a lot of area and very limited resources. And so the area is a net importer of dairy and meat products just to meet demand. They can't produce enough to do that. Further exacerbating that is that they're a net feed grain and forage importer because they can't produce enough of that either. And when they do produce it, they've got real problems with quality and productivity of that. And those are driving factors that affect their ability to produce. And so the concept behind this project was that we have improved forage. They're familiar with growing forage sorghums. They've grown them for many, many years, and they fit into their systems. But they're very lacking. They did not have the brown midrib genotypes or phenotypes that that we know from many years of work in the States and other areas improve forage quality of sorghum significantly. And so really the premise was, can we bring some of these types and put them into adapted cultivars in that region and see if producers will adopt them? For purposes of what we're calling, and I just put this map on this page because it fit, Central America, we're defining Central America for this project from Guatemala down to Panama. Okay, so Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, and Panama are our target area within this region. And sorghum is traditionally grown from Guatemala through northern Costa Rica. It's not as common in Panama and southern Costa Rica. So our objectives were to take some BMR sources and develop varieties of sorghum that fit into that dual purpose category for small producers that basically performed in terms of adaptation like what they already have. I'm not trying to change that. If we can improve that, great. But the bottom line is we want to maintain grain productivity and forage productivity while improving forage quality by introducing the brown midrib trait into these backgrounds. And then because we're working over a pretty diverse geographical area and we're working with six different countries, work with the national programs in the national agricultural programs in those different countries to evaluate the material and identify variety or varieties that work within their region, because we realize that they're not all going to fit every one of these particular environments. To support that, we need to educate agronomists and small farmers, and when we say all small farmers, but really at the initial stages here, the early adopters and the folks that would be primarily responsible for seed production as we move forward with this, because remember, these are varieties, they're not hybrids, and the seed industry in this area is pretty minimal, and they focus primarily on those farmers that grow hybrids because there's a market return there. And then finally, once we've identified those and educated some folks and generated enough seed to get this started, make the releases, put these out in the hands of the people that can demonstrate them, and then advance them and spread them throughout the region as appropriate for the situation. So we start back with the story actually before the project actually formally began, back to do the development, because we didn't have these characteristics in the Central American germplasm. And so as part of our InstruMill project, we moved some of our brown midrib sources from Texas A&M into the region, working with the Cinta program in El Salvador primarily to do the breeding, and follow just traditional breeding approaches, crossing local cultivars with those brown midrib sources, which were good lines in South Texas. So we had a little bit of adaptation there, but still not really adapted to that region of the world. And then we did all of our selection in region, and we selected in both cycles or both seasons of growing. The rainy season from May to August, we would select in that generation, and then come back immediately in the fall season, which is the dry season, and select the next generation in that season. So we could do two cycles a year in that process. And the pictures show making the crosses originally, Nuri making the crosses, and Salvador and I walking nurseries selecting material in the F3 generation. So as we went through this, we were obviously paring the list down and selecting for more lowly heritable traits as we get toward the end of that process, to the point where we got to the F6, where we had about 15 genotypes or 15 derived lines that we thought had potential. And it's time to advance now to this multi-location testing across the regions. And so we set up a testing program of 2 years with seven environments, six of them in region. Actually, I've got one missing there somewhere. Guatemala's not on that list. I forgot Guatemala. And then one location in South Texas as well, just to compare and contrast the difference of these things in a more subtropical environment. And so we worked with the national programs. The abbreviations are listed on the right. Don't ask me to remember exactly what they all mean in Spanish, because I don't. I know some of the key ones. But in each region, we had an agronomist that was responsible for helping or assisting us in finding locations and planting these trials. And then a graduate student, Ostelio Portillo, was part of this from our program, who went down at every location and coordinated collecting data at harvest and working through it with those folks to make sure that the data collection was consistent across the region. In each location, we actually planted these twice, once in the spring or the wet season, and once in the fall and the dry season. And we collected different data in each of those seasons. In the wet season, the primary use of that was envisioned as forage, and in the fall, it was primarily envisioned as a grain crop with forage residue left over. And so you see that in the list of data that we collected at each of these locations. In the spring, it was the standard agronomic things, as well as biomass composition as a forage crop, and you'll see that. And in the fall, we focused more on the grain composition in that crop and the yields of that, although we did look at biomass composition at that time as well. So here's a list of these pedigrees. They don't mean anything to any one of you. I will point out that basically, if you look at the first, the pedigree to the right of the designation, we always list the tropically adapted cultivar that we used in crossing, and then the BMR source on the right. These are all first derivative crosses, but they were selected heavily back toward the tropically adapted parent. In fact, many of these lines, when you look at them, have similarities very much like the RCV or the VG146 or the S3 in that sense. And that was done very much on purpose, because we wanted to get back to something that farmers were familiar with. All of these lines that you see in here are commonly grown in the region, and farmers have accepted and grown over the years. So just a few pictures of the evaluations. The top one is in Panama, the bottom one is in Guatemala. They don't look all that different, and I don't know why there's a row of corn in the middle of that one. I still don't know to this day, because I didn't go there. Ostelio was there, but that's definitely not sorghum in that one row. These trials were grown and managed per standard production practices in that region, and we got the data back. And I don't want you to look through all these numbers, but I do want you to point out one thing. The 15 lines are on here. We also grew a check. Actually, in every location, we grew a common check known as Sureño, which is probably the gold standard for this type of variety in the region, across the region. It was released in the mid-80s and is still common in the area and represents the standard. In addition to that, the test allowed for each country, each program, to put in up to four more of their local checks. But those varied from country to country, so I don't include them in here. But the main thing I want to point out to you here is that if you look at biomass yield and grain yield, the check wins, all right? That Sureño is still at the top, although it's not numerically or statistically different than many of those others. And so when we compared the performance of the brown midrib versus the non-brown midrib checks that were in these trials, we did see overall a reduction in biomass yield and grain yield with them. And that wasn't too terribly surprising. We had more brown midrib lines to evaluate, and we were evaluating them against the standards for those regions that have been established for many years. But the point was, is we did find some varieties or some particular lines in here that did quite well and weren't statistically different than the lines that they were being compared with. And those were the ones that we went forward with. And so that's basically what this says, is that we did have, as a group, those lines did have those lower yields, but we could find individual lines that were comparable. All right. What those other slide didn't show, and I'll show you for one particular line in a few minutes, is that consistently the BMR lines did what we expected. They lowered fiber, acid detergent fiber concentration, acid detergent lignin concentration, and we had higher in vitro dry matter digestibility consistently on those things across locations and even across the varieties when we compared them back to that. There was one particular line that was identified as consistently good across the trials, and that line was CI947 BMR, and that line was one that the group proposed for universal release throughout the region, each country releasing that one. And then we also recommended to each country that, okay, that's one we're going to do across the region. Let's also, if there's another one that you want to release in your country, by all means, go right ahead and do that so that you offer producers a couple choices in terms of how that works. And so if we look at that 947, and I think the best way to do that is just to look at some of this, briefly look at some of the data, and I don't know if there's a pin up here or not, but it does work. The locations here where you see multiple locations in the same year, those are simply the spring and fall planting dates. For maturity, no difference across the environment. For plant height, no difference across the environment. You do see some differences in particular environments. For dry biomass yield, when we looked across environments with this line, no difference between the check and it. And grain yield the same thing. And so agronomically we're in the ballpark, and if we look at fiber concentrations or quality, here's where we start to see the differences as soon as the projector comes back on. We saw a consistent drop across the environments, in every environment, for acid detergent lignin, and acid detergent fiber was down as well, although combined it was not significant. What I don't have up here is the dry matter digestibility, and that was similar to the lignin. So we think we hit where we want to be in terms of quality and improving that. On the grain side, which is equally important, we didn't want to change those. The proximates on the grain were pretty much non-significant, except for we saw a slight reduction in starch, and statistically significant but practically not important differences in fiber and fat. So we're in terms of grain quality and looking at milling and utilization and feeding, these were right in line with what we wanted. So like I said, we identified this line, and then each country was able to identify additional lines. Our next step was to go to, we got to produce some seed. And so we transferred this primarily into initial phases of seed production done by each of the national programs, following standard seed production practices, and these folks were educated in that with workshops before we started that. They spent 2 days in El Salvador working with our collaborator there, who I'll mention at the end, who educated them on the right way to go through and rogue fields, removing that, making sure your isolations were correct, harvesting at the right time, and threshing appropriately to maintain seed quality. And so in each country, seed was produced enough to make sure we had enough to distribute to key component projects as the releases became new. In addition to teaching folks how to produce seed that were going to be key leaders in that, we also held technical capacity workshops for agronomists, both national agronomists and important regional agronomists, whether they be with private companies, NGOs, whomever, that were identified in each of these regions, that were going to help educate farmers as these things moved out. And these were held over 2011 and 2012, and they involved going to field locations, evaluating material, a little bit of a lecture on the benefits to the dairy producer, what happens when you reduce these quality factors that are the lignin, etc., and improve digestibility, and how do you utilize that. And then looking at them as the key people that are going to move this forward after we move out and they're on their own. And so all these folks went through these, we sent about 40 to 50 people through these little workshops. I think we did two or three of them over that time in various places in the region to get them up to speed and get them interested in this material. Following that, we went through the official standard release protocol in Central America, which is to put up a big tent and invite people to come and look at things. And then the ceremonial handing of the bag of seed, which I don't know why I had to do. I wasn't there all the time. Well, the folks that did it probably should have done that, but they wanted me to do it. And so in each country, we officially released the CO947. It was released in different countries by different names, each of the national programs putting their own brand on that, because that's what you have to do to get them engaged in that. In addition, these countries also would identify in another line, typically, and so they typically were releasing two varieties at a time out of this set of material. The other one was the one that showed best adaptation in their particular region and trials. Once we did that, those release events were combined with a field day for small producers who had been alerted of this through their national programs and their agronomists that, hey, these are coming. If they had signed up to come to the field day prior to it, they were eligible to receive a couple kilograms of seed that we had produced through the initial seed production process. And that was very well received, and we had a lot of farmers at these producer meetings, typically 40 to 50, maybe even 100 in some locations in certain countries. And the education process went on with that. We employed those local agronomists to give the spiel about how these are different, why they're better in certain ways, what do you have to watch out for in terms of weaknesses in doing these. And they typically had a brochure that they handed out that gave that information to them in writing if they were so inclined to do that. We also did some recordings and put some things on websites. Hopefully some of the locals saw that, but that may have been primarily a PR for the program. So, to sort of close it up, what's the impact? Well, we released these in 2012, and the initial distributions that we made, we know that there was 8,000 hectares grown in region the first year. Now, the program closed down shortly after we finished this all up. And so we also know that seed production continues. The national programs are continuing to produce these varieties, and they're selling them now to local farmers at their varieties. So they don't have to, they sell them enough to get them started, but the concept is that the farmer can actually save the seed and grow it again if he's so inclined, or he can go purchase it from the national program or from other little distributors that are actually selling them in region as well. So we know that that's happening, and we went back and we talked to the folks that were in the know in the region in 2014 just to get some idea of where we were. And the best estimate, and these are not scientifically, they're not survey drawn, they're simply, hey, what have you got in your region, was that we were up to about 40,000 hectares, okay? And so they have been adopted, and people utilize them, primarily going into the dairies. And the one thing that the comment that we got consistently back was that the people using them like to plant them in June and harvest a biomass crop in August or September, let it regrow. That was the biggest driver of this, is that there was multiple seasons of harvest. They could then harvest a grain crop in December, harvest the biomass that's left over, feed that, and if they still had moisture in the ground, they'd let it grow a third time. And so that was, and that's something we didn't even test for. Okay, we knew you could do it, but it was not within the realm of what we tested or how we worked on that. So that's really where the program is. And we if it's like all the other varietal releases done in this region, once producers get a hold of it and learn how to grow it, if they like it, they'll grow it until you give them something better. Okay, and I hope at least for the dairy industry that we're doing the same thing. So that's, I want to acknowledge this fellow right here, and he was on the author sheet. But Rene Clara Valencia was a sorghum breeder for Senta in El Salvador for 30 years. And he was really the guy that did this. Okay, I get to stand up here and talk to you, but he's the guy that coordinated the crossing, coordinated planting the nurseries, doing the selection, and then went everywhere pushing this idea to those local agronomists and communicating to them the importance of doing this and the value of doing this. And so in collaboration with him, and I was lucky enough to work with him to do this, it was again funded by the Instramill through USAID and Feed the Future activities, and these are all the participating organizations. So that's all I have.